So welcome to this class about the Empire and James Cook. And so we're going to go back a couple of hundred years to 1452. It's in the 15th century that there is already the beginnings of exploration around from the European powers, and this is the reason that the Pope gets interested in it. Remember, the Pope is still already a very powerful figure, and he issues this papal bull in 1452. This is not the beginning. This is because the question has already been posed. And it's called, this is a papal bull called Dum Diversas, which means talking about different things. And this bull grants to Portugal and to Spain, and I quote, full and free permission to invade, search out, capture and subjugate unbelievers and enemies of Christ, wherever they may be, and to reduce them into perpetual slavery. This is 1452. Okay, it has the c'est l'avantage de la clarté, on dit. You know where he stands, and that is the one of the key moments. Now, of course, if he brought out this, it was not that the Pope had the idea of colonialism. It was that it was beginning to happen, and the Pope wanted to support a particular practice. While I'm at it, I just recommend this book, which actually came out too late for last year's exams. It only came out a couple of months ago, but this is a really very solid book. Probably you would find, if you read it, you'll probably find there are too many details, but that's often the case. But it is pretty well structured there. So that was the papal bull, and of course only 40 years later, good old or not good old Christopher Columbus wanders off across the ocean and finds what he thinks is India, but which isn't India, it's Cuba, he performs a ceremony when he arrives in the Americas. He performs a ceremony to take possession of all lands discovered. This is the discovery doctrine, which says if you arrive somewhere and no other Christian nation has already been there, then you can take possession of it, and it's okay. So the reason for this ceremony is to try to have some sort of honour among thieves. That is to say, to have an informal agreement that, oh well, if the Spanish got there first, okay, well that bit's for them, and we'll go somewhere else. Yeah. So as to, there are of course wars going on, but so as to avoid there being a perpetual war going on. Now obviously the people who lived in the places being taken possession of were not going to have a great idea. Now, while later, to just to mention the Pope for a moment, while later popes did denounce the dehumanization of Native Americans, none of the papal bulls were ever repealed, which declared that all discovered lands now belong to Europeans. So today, obviously, the consensus view among historians is quite different, and it would be rather surprising today to see a historian write, Cook discovered New Zealand. That we would usually say, well, he was the first European to arrive in New Zealand, or he discovered New Zealand for Europe, but we wouldn't just put it there in this idea. Now, Christopher Columbus, of course, who was Italian but worked for the Spanish monarch. One of the advantages of working for the Spanish monarch in the 15th, 16th century is the most fabulous tomb. This is the tomb of Christopher Columbus in Seville Cathedral, which, you know, I'm hoping to have a tomb like that. I'm counting on you for organising it, but not yet. Okay, so Christopher Columbus off he went, and just after Christopher Columbus went over there, then there was a treaty which was brokered by the Pope and signed by the Portuguese and the Spanish, the Treaty of Tordesillas, and this declared that only non-Christian lands could be colonized under the doctrine of discovery. Yeah, so this is the same thing in order to make the process more less dangerous, less uneven, less chaotic, and indeed the Treaty of Tordesillas divided the newly discovered lands outside Europe between the Portuguese Empire and the Spanish Empire along a meridian just west of the Cape Verde Islands off the west coast of Africa. So about halfway between the Cape Verde Islands and the islands already claimed by Christopher Columbus, Cuba and so on. Now, as for England, England was a bit of a latecomer to empire. Spain and Portugal were the big ones. This is why, of course, most of South America speaks Spanish, except for Brazil, which is not a small country, which speaks Portuguese. On the British side, and this will be significant for Australia, is that King Henry VII adopted the doctrine of discovery. So yes, that's right, we agree with all that, and grants to his explorers the right, including Cabo, for example, the right to assert dominion title over all non-Christian lands. So all that's then at the end of the 15th century. All this is happening. This is a picture. This is not actually Henry VII. It's just a statue. But there you go. Meanwhile, what were the French doing? Well, the French were doing what they could. And they sent an expedition to Florida in 1562. And set up a small colony there, but only a few years later this was captured by the Spanish. I should say that this expedition of the French was an expedition of French Protestants running away from religious oppression. But they only lasted a few years, and then the Spanish took it over. So this is in 1562, and just a little later, and something which is very significant for Cook's future, is the expeditions of Martin Frobisher, who is English, who he lived in the period when privileged classes were obliged to wear ridiculous trousers, as you can see from the picture. He was an English seaman and privateer, so he wasn't officially representing England. He was just kind of the crown used to give permission to privateers to go on, you're allowed to whatever you get, you can have it. What's important of him is he went off to the northeast of Canada, looking for the Northwest Passage, as this passage over the top of North America, which would be so useful and so profitable if you could find it. And in fact, when they eventually found it centuries later, it's very small and it's frozen most of the time, so it's not really very useful. In fact, you could say that there isn't a Northwest Passage in the sense that if it's frozen most of the time, it's not much use to you. Frobisher then went over, and he went into Frobisher Bay. It's named the bay after him. It's still called that. And he found, it was quite a funny story actually, because he took home 200 tons of gold ore. But it was later discovered that it actually wasn't gold. It was something else. So he was a bit of a failure from that point of view. Notice that in the far north, the interests of the empire would probably be to trade or to find gold, because when you're in the north of Canada, you're not going to colonize it because it's too cold. Okay, so let's move over to the Pacific and Australia. So is this all the context is, the whole world appears to be in some ways up for grabs, because first of all, now the ships are good enough to have a chance of coming back alive. Secondly, the techniques of commerce and banking are beginning to actually happen to make it worthwhile going to the other side of the world and trying to find places you can trade, or places you could set up a trading center, whether it be in India or Australia or Alaska, the European countries who have the money and the ships. This is what they're looking at, and also their technology is getting better. Remember that it's still technology when it's a water wheel or a canal. It doesn't just become technology once Dell or Microsoft are doing it. So if we look at the European attempts to look around Australia, then the first one is Willem Janszoon. Who, as you can see by his name, was Italian. No, Dutch. Who was Dutch. And 1605, 1606, okay, off he went to the coast of Western New Guinea. So this is above, well, you see the map there. At the bottom you have Australia, or as they say, New Holland. And then you have New Guinea is just above it. New Guinea is just above it. They have Borneo and so on. And this was his expedition, is to go all the way along Indonesia and to land on Australia. The first recorded European to land on Australian soil. He was searching for gold. But he reported that that it was very difficult to be friendly with the locals, who just wanted them to go away, and indeed several of his men were killed. 40 years later, the Dutch Council of the Indies, at this time the Dutch and the Spanish were part of the same empire. We've talked about the Spanish Netherlands. They sent off another an official expedition this time, and this was by Abel Tasman. And here we are getting more to people who remain known today, because of course Tasman has Tasmania named after him. So where did he go? They were exploring, because they were looking at places where there were not very many maps, and the maps that there were not very good. I don't know if you remember in the journals, but from time to time, especially in the third voyage, Cook complains. He says, "I have a map. I came with a map from some other explorer, but the map's no good, and it shows places in the wrong place." Yeah, because you know, it's just like, you know. If you and me went off round the world in a ship and drew a map, well, you know, it wouldn't be that useful. Now, of course, Tasman was better than that, but it was sometimes quite approximate. His objective was to obtain knowledge, and I quote, of all the totally unknown provinces, which they were quite convinced were rich in gold. From this period, after Tasman and before Cook, a number of other Europeans visited the west and north coast of Australia, as well as Tasmania. And so, of course, what is new for Cook is that he visits the east coast. So you see here, to one of Tasman's voyages, you can see him going round there. Those are two of his voyages. Now these are actually huge. Well, you've got the scale there, 1,200 kilometres. So this is 3,000 kilometres for he goes across Australia. These are huge expeditions. Of course, very exciting. And this is where Tasman goes. Now, when he gets to New Zealand, it's not quite clear exactly what happened. So we're not quite clear if he landed or not. But he certainly met the Maori, and here you have the picture of a drawing at the time. This is a time drawing by, as I understand it, I think I'm right, by somebody who was on Tasman's ship, 1642 drawing then. Yes, that's right. And so he's drawing this canoe with local people in it, and you can see behind it, yeah, the flags. I don't know why they are tricolours. Because this is before the French tricolour, okay? Ask me next week. Okay, so you've got all these European visitors, but there were also other visitors. If you remember the geography of this, there you go. In fact, there were regularly tradesmen from Indonesia visiting the north of Australia. For hundreds and hundreds of years, there was local travel, yeah, from Indonesia. I don't know why I'm pointing, you can't see that. But from Indonesia, travelling to Australia and back, so this is local. And of course, in the imperial view of the world, this doesn't count. Yeah, it only counts when Europeans get there. But there had been some travelling around. And as I mentioned in one of the videos about Tupaya, the amount of navigational knowledge was huge. That when they got Tupaya on board the Endeavour to draw a map, he drew a map, and when they understood it, they realised that from one side to the other of the map was 2,200 miles. So there was a huge amount of knowledge, hundreds of islands. They knew where hundreds of islands were. But interestingly enough, Tupaia had no knowledge of New Zealand. He didn't say, "Oh, there's a big island over there we never go to." He didn't know where it was. Okay, so I've got my two computers here. I'm going at the same time. But of all these visitors so far, did not claim possession of any part of Australia. Yeah. Tasman or other people before, they did not claim possession. Now, perhaps they there wasn't that confidence and commercial need. This is a period of travel for other places too. The Ming voyages. These are the voyages from China. These are voyages from China in the we've got the date there, 1405 to 33. So this is not in chronological order. It's just to mention that in other parts of the world there are also things going on. And you can see there that from China you've got them travelling all the way down to Indonesia and then across to Africa on the other side. This is all the Chinese voyages, the voyages of Zheng He. Okay, so let's get back to the 18th century, the European powers. That is to say, the context of empire just a few years before Cook sets off on the endeavour. Well, the main element here is the Seven Years' War. The Seven Years' War, and Britain was at war with... the Seven Years' War. I've got two different dates. Yeah, from 1754 to 1763. Now, if you count, you realise that's 9 years. And yes, this is the bad news. The Seven Years' War actually lasted 9 years. I don't know why. Conflict began in 1754 with British attacks on French positions in North America. So these were places where the French said, oh, this part is ours. And the British said, no, it isn't, actually. If you look, it's ours, really. And so you got the... Now, the Seven Years' War was a big deal. The Seven Years' War was the first global war for empire. The Seven Years' War had fighting on five continents, five different continents. So it's a completely different kind of war to the previous ones. Now the main combatants were England and France. England, I should say the United Kingdom, because we all because Scotland has already been integrated in 1707. At this time, England, in any case, it says in my notes, had a population of 8 million. The French had far more population, and you know, in general, the bigger country has an advantage. But the English technology was superior, and the beginnings of technological changes were going on. And in particular, the English navy was far stronger than the French. Now, they were France and Austria also were worried about Britain getting too strong. And so Austria proposed an alliance with France, even though they'd been in war at war with France not so long before. In 1756, the Battle of England against France in Minorca, and the French won Minorca. Politically a very high temperature in England at the time, and the British admiral who fought in Minorca was then executed for incompetence. You know, they sorted them out seriously at these times. You're executing your admiral for incompetence. You know, it's quite heavy. Yeah. And interestingly enough, in Voltaire's book Candide, there is a page which satirises the execution of Byng. Even more interesting, in 2007, Admiral Byng's great 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 grandson. Appealed to the British government to have his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather pardoned, and the British government refused. That's not really very important, but I thought it was amazingly amusing. 1759, battle at Quiberon Bay. I think that's the Quiberon Bay in France, and here you have the Battle of Quiberon Bay. Of course, that's a painting. And you can see these are huge ships with a couple of hundred people on them, and a lot of cannons. And a lot of people get drowned, yes. And you can see there, I have the slide, the figures of the number of people who were killed. Now, we sometimes have the impression, if we're not, you know, we don't look too much in the 18th century, when we think of horrible wars, we think of the 20th century, you know, the First World War and the Normandy landings that are horrible with all this high technology, machine guns and so on. But the naval battles of the 18th century were also pretty vicious, and one of their favourite tactics was the fire ship, where you get an old ship and you put it on fire and you send it to into the midst of the enemy ships, and then they have the choice to drown or to be burnt to death. Remember that most sailors cannot swim. The reason for this is that it's partly fatalism, and it's partly that, you know, you usually such a long way from shore that, you know, you would just drown a few hours later. So they didn't bother learning to swim. So in any case, the up and down of this is that the British had established naval superiority at sea, and they were hoping to benefit from this. And indeed, part of the atmosphere around Cook's expeditions is, you know, we're the strongest at sea. You know, I was going to say "Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves," but that's later the song. And they, you know, they were hoping to make the most of it, and encouraging Cook's expeditions was part of, well, you know, let's see, you know, what is there out there? You know, now we're the strongest, we have the best commerce, we have the best ships, and they really did have the best ships, the three masted and so on. So this is part of the atmosphere around it, and indeed in Africa, it was very clear that the British were making gains, and a whole series of slaving stations in West Africa, sugar islands in the Caribbean, and large parts of India all came under British control. Meanwhile, in North America, the French and the British were still fighting away. 1758, the British mounted an attack on New France, you know, La Nouvelle France, and the French fortress at Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island fell to the British in 1758. And the following year, General James Wolfe, the British hero, defeated the French forces at Quebec. By 1760, French America had become British. And it still is British. By 1760, French America had become British. And it still is British, except that in the 20th century, there's been more space for the French-speaking minority to have certain cultural rights. But it was it's under the history of it being British. And there we have the Battle of Louisbourg. Okay. General James Wolfe. He died in 1759. In fact, yes, he won the battle and then died. There he is, dying. And as you can see, they like to make these wonderful poetic, romantic paintings. So he seems to be dying quite comfortably there in the middle. And you'll notice on the left there, one of the Native Americans. One of the interesting things about the Seven Years' War is in the United States they have a different name for it. Maybe this is because nobody's sure if it's 7 years or 9 years. But they call it the French and Indian War. Which is an interesting point, because one of the elements to remember about it is that the different Native American tribes were sometimes allies of the British and sometimes allies of the French, and tried to see which allyship would turn out best for them, which is a good contrast to the old-fashioned view of history where the Native Americans just sit there and die. Yeah. In fact, not. So the war ended eventually, the Seven Years' War ended with the Treaty of Paris, signed in 1763. And basically, this was the end of French colonial power in North America. They'd lost, and so they thought, well, we might as well sign a treaty and put, no, that's finished, move on to the next thing. But they did, the French did get a bit of a consolation prize, because it's not very big, and it's something you see every day on the television, and it is Saint-Pierre et Miquelon. Alors je dois avouer que j'ai dû regarder sur Google Maps pour savoir où ça se trouvait, but there it is, just over there near Canada, Saint-Pierre et Miquelon, which is still French, very French. I've never heard of anybody who came from there who has been there, but I'm sure somebody must have done. So the British were a bit cheeky and said, oh, well, we'll have that, we'll have all that, and you can have that, okay? Okay. This was a victory for the British, obviously, a victory for the British, but things were moving quickly, and this late 1760, remember, this victory for the British laid the grounds for the American Revolution. Firstly, because of bad treatment by the British Army of colonial soldiers. When you have the British Army in North America, many of them have never been to Britain. They're local Americans who've been hired. They're still considered to be British, although they've been living in America for 100 years. And secondly, because in order to win the war, the British government had borrowed a huge amount of money, which they had to pay back. And so they thought, well, we'll just put more taxes on the colonials. And as you know, the beginnings of the American revolts was a lot to do with this slogan, no taxation without representation. That is to say that the American colonists said, how many members of parliament do us American colonists have in the parliament in London? Zero. Why should we pay taxes if we don't have any representation? There you go. Now, so that's one of the contexts. So you can see the fighting going on between the different empires, and Britain getting a consolidating a strong position here and looking for a, you know, looking for a glorious future, or an interesting future anyway. And indeed, the fact that, well, I'll come back to that in a moment, actually, what happens in America. The other huge context is the slave trade between 1600 and 1850. Around 12 million enslaved Africans were shipped across the Atlantic. And during the course of the 18th century, so in these years, the 50 years before Cook, if you like, and 50 years after, no, 30 years after Cook, the slave trade is abolished in the British Empire in 1807. The trade, not slavery, but the slave trade is abolished in 1807. And indeed, between 1700 and 1810, British merchants transported almost 3 million enslaved Africans across the Atlantic. Now, in the 1790s, so just after Cook, there were 20,000 black people living in London. So it's not a huge community, but it's a real community. Slavery was extremely profitable, and it has been said that Britain would probably have had a full industrial revolution without the money made from the slave trade, but the revolution would have been much later and not as comprehensive, not as thoroughgoing. Bristol, Birmingham, Liverpool, Bordeaux, Nantes were built on money from slavery. Also, the one of the main factors here is sugar. During the 18th century, sugar became enormously popular, and the sugar market went through a series of booms. The heightened demand and production of sugar came about to a large extent in order to a great change in the eating habits of Europeans. They began consuming jam, candy, tea, coffee, cocoa, and so on and so forth. And the islands in the Caribbean, the place it was produced, they produced up to 90% of the sugar consumed in Western Europe. We mustn't get confused by today. Of course, today sugar is cheap. You can find people, I really haven't got any money this month, I can't go to the restaurant, but I don't have enough money to buy sugar. You really don't have any money at all. Yeah, this was not the case in the 18th century. Sugar was quite expensive. This was of course the slave production of sugar in the British West Indies, as we called them then. I have 136 horrible stories about slavery in the West Indies, so I'll just give you three. The laws were extremely cruel. If a slave hit a white man, his hand was cut off. Giving as a birthday present a slave woman to rape for a white, that was the normal thing to do. This was not something extreme. And also, interestingly enough, the children of slaves were automatically slaved, although their father could often be a white slave master. In the 1760s, just to give a little clue about this, the House of Assembly in Jamaica made it illegal to leave money to the children of slave women. You see, from time to time, I'm not quite sure how often this was, but slave owners would be attached to their children, even though they were illegitimate children who were the children of slave women. The white elite were very frightened of the becoming a sort of mixed half-black sort of middle class, and they want to make sure that was not the case. And so they passed a law and said that, you know, no white master is allowed to leave their money to the children of a slave woman. So the idea was not just to treat individuals badly, but to stabilize a system which was working for them. These slaves were captured by raiding parties in Africa, imprisoned at coastal forts, and then sent across the Atlantic on ships, where the standard space per slave was defined, officially defined by the British Royal Africa Company, 5 foot long, 11 inches wide, and 23 inches high for a voyage lasting 9 or 10 months. Around 1 in 6 slaves died on the journey, sometimes just escaping and jumping overboard because they preferred to drown. And not only the slaves, the African society as a whole was devastated, and it has been estimated that the population of Western and Central Africa was halved within 60, 70 years or so. Now, the last thing I'd like to say about the slave trade is that because it's such a horrible thing, we are sometimes tempted to think of it a bit like, you know, the trade today in heroin. You know, horrible, rather really very dishonest criminal sorts making money out of something that most people find disgusting. This is not the case at all. Slave trade was very much accepted. Better off shopkeepers would invest their money in slave trading because it was extremely profitable. Just to give you an example, in 1787 there were 41 members on Liverpool Municipal Council, 41 councillors. 37 of them were involved in the slave trade. And 20 Lord Mayors, every Lord Mayor between 1787 and 1807 was involved in the slave trade. It was an accepted thing. The Church of England was the biggest owner of slaves in Barbados, and profits from plantations were directly used to finance the building of churches. And interestingly enough, in 2006, so 15 years ago, the Church of England officially apologised for the profits they made from slavery, and they set up some sort of compensatory actions, for example, university grants reserved for black people, that kind of thing, yeah, okay, which has caused a whole another huge debate. Now, this is why we're not really surprised when James Cook, he comes across slavery 3 or 4 times in the journal, and he doesn't comment on it. There's nothing shocking for him, you know. He just said, you're the people who repaired our ship with their slaves. There's no story here. There is another story about Cook and slavery, and that is that on his second voyage, when he arrived in Cape Town, he was able to read the book written by Hawkesworth, which was the account of the first voyage. And Hawkesworth was a fine writer and made it very exciting and much easier to read than Cook's journals. However, he was not too worried about being exactly precise, and so what he did is he used Cook's journals and Joseph Banks' journals, which were better written, and he'd say, oh, Cook said this, but in fact it was Banks, but it doesn't matter, you know, he would just put everything, because James Cook was the famous captain, Hawkesworth just put the words of Banks or the words of Cook into Cook's mouth, and sold it like that, and so, James Cook didn't like that. When he's actually quite furious about this, because he was a naval officer, and he was attached to accuracy, and you know, if I said it, I said it, and if I didn't say it, I didn't say it, and so he was actually furious about that. But also, there may be more specific things he was angry about. Now, we're not sure. But one of the things that he was angry about was that in St. Helena, the book by Hawkesworth had said that Cook was very negative about the people of St. Helena, and said several negative things about them, including they were very cruel to their slaves. Now, in fact, Banks said this, but in Hawkesworth's book, Cook said it, and it may be that this was one of the things that made Cook angry, because he was a military officer, and he did not want to have published that he had political opinions. Also, they were not his opinions, they were Banks. But also, you know, I'm a military officer, I don't have political opinions. I think that would be the logical way. Now, interestingly enough, Cook does say that he disapproves of eating one's dead enemies, as they do I think it's quite fun. No, I haven't done it recently. But he never says anything against slavery. But we can't really be surprised, because, you know, he's a military officer at the British Empire and so on. Now, there were, in the 18th century, slave rebellions were quite common. For example, in 1752, on the ship Marlborough, the slaves revolted and killed most of the crew and forced the last few to take them home to Africa. Of course, the revolts generally lost, but sometimes they won. And fugitive slaves escaped and set up their own communities living in the mountains of the West Indies. And it's just after Cook's time that the movement in Britain for the abolition of the slave trade begins to get going. And in May 1787, they have the meeting in a tavern in London, and there are 12 people, and they set up the Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. And you can imagine all their friends thought, you're just completely nuts. You're just mad. There's 12 of you, and you're going to abolish the slave trade, which is making billions of dollars. But, you know, there you go. 9 of the 12 founders were Quakers, which is an interesting sign about the importance of minority religion. And it went along. There's a monument to one of the slave revolts on the Dutch island of Curaçao. And here are a couple of the elements used by the anti-slavery movements. So you can see that first of all on the right, you have East India sugar not made by slaves. And this is what they made these and sold them. And this was so that obviously among the middle class, your guests would come and take their sugar, and it would be marking, we don't buy slave sugar. So it was a boycott, but before the word was invented in Ireland in the 19th century. Can you see that? East India sugar not made by slaves. Yeah, so it's like, you know, having a thing at home. And on the other one, is again tea, so everybody was going to have sugar with it. And you have the slogan, health to the sick, that is, we wish health to the sick, we wish honour to the brave, success to the lover and freedom to the slave. Yeah, so you have a slogan on your teapot. Yeah, it's well, I have tea towels with radical slogans on at home, so why not teapots? And just one French example, which is exactly from the time of Cook, because this is 1761. I don't know if any of you have heard this story, but this is a story about the slave context, that in 1761 the French ship L'Utile, and this is the sign at the poster for an exhibition that was on about it. This was also an exhibition this exhibition later went to Bordeaux. And the French ship L'Utile was transporting slaves from Madagascar to Mauritius, and they were wrecked. Now, many of the slaves drowned because nobody would let them out of the cellar of the downstairs. But they arrived in on the island with the French crew, and about 60 slaves. They had the wreck of the ship, and so they managed to build a new boat, but it was a much, much smaller boat. 6 months later, I haven't got the exact date, a few months later, 122 French sailors left the island on this new boat that they had built, and they left the 60 slaves on the island and promised to come back and rescue them. But they didn't come back and rescue them, and they couldn't get permission from the governor because the war was going on or whatever. It is 12 years later, a ship passing found the slaves and reported them, and a first boat was sent, and a second boat was sent, and they didn't manage to get to the island because the weather was very bad. And finally, 15 years after the slaves had arrived, a ship arrived, managed to get there, and rescued the survivors, 7 women and 1 baby. I don't know what I think. So it's a very, very interesting historical point, because it was an isolated island, so archaeologists have been able to go there and discover a load of things about the life of the slaves during those 15 years, because nobody had been there since. Yeah, so obviously it's a sign of how vicious the institution of slavery was. You know, they just didn't count as human beings. After that, after the Seven Years' War, the tension between American colonists and the British Parliament is getting bigger and bigger, and it's concession, aggression. The British abolish some taxes, and then under great pressure, and famously they abolish all the taxes that are contested, except for the tax on tea. And this is the origin of the well-known British Tea Party, Boston Tea Party, where a bunch of colonials, disguised as Indians, those are not Indians, they're disguised as Indians, and they throw all the tea into the harbour, and gets more and more tense, and gets more aggravated, and when the British troops come in 1775 to take back a collection of arms which the colonials have, they are shot at, and this is what we always know as the gunshot that echoed around the world. I think that's the one, and then you have the Battle of Lectonshire, and so it's a war. So it's then a war, and the American War of Independence becomes a symbol around the world for everybody who hates the old way of doing things. They want a republic. A republic? My God, we haven't had one of those since Cromwell in Britain. So it was seen as something extremely radical and new, and a whole new world, and a new way of looking at religion, because the American colonists were very much very influenced by Puritans and by dissenters. And of course, the difficulty that the British had is that when you're fighting a war at the other side of the world, your supply lines are very, very long. And so the British were obliged, and this is going on then during Cook's voyages, 1775, the Battle of Lexington, 1776, the publication of Common Sense by Tom Paine, the great radical tract which will inspire the world, and will very much inspire the French revolutionaries later as well. In 1783, then a couple of years after Cook's death, Britain is obliged to sign the Treaty of Paris and to evacuate New York. So what have we got? I've talked about the imperial competition. I've talked about the situation in America where Britain is just losing one of the biggest colonies, which was quite profitable. In the south it was profitable because of tobacco, and in the north it was profitable because of fish, and also because of furs. Fish was huge money. I'm told that it's very easy to catch fish near Canada. I mean, like tons of fish. And the trading card transformed the health of Europeans, actually. Because it was easier to get decent fish. And there's a wonderful book, history book called Cod. It's just the history of the fish. It's a really good way of looking at it. So the British are in a good position on the seas, but they're in the process, and they're not stupid, they know, they're in the process of having great problems in America. They might lose America. And so we understand why they are particularly interested in checking out this southern continent, which must be huge and very rich. And then the romantics among them are saying, oh, you know, we didn't find those noble savages in America. They're not that noble. So let's have a look further south. The other big story of the 18th century is British India. British India is under the influence of Britain, although it's not generally by settler colonialism for the time being. There's a small part of India occupied by Britain, and the rest of it is heavily influenced by Britain, but in a rather unusual way. This is kind of privatized colonialism. The British Crown gave permission to the East India Company, and that's their headquarters in London, to have the monopoly on trade with India, and to, you know, to represent the Crown, but without much control in India. So it's a private company, but like, you know, McDonald's, but a rather unusual private company, because at one point they asked the government, can we have our private army? And the government said, oh yeah, you can have your private army. So are we allowed to print our own money? Oh yes, you're allowed to print your own money. So it was a rather unusual kind of government, and they occupied more and more. I won't give you the whole story. They occupied more and more of India, taking over. I mean, India is huge. I mean, from the point of view of geography, and also from the point of view of population, and so you had this huge thing. But the government, the British government, were beginning to intervene. Beginning to say, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't just leave it to a company, partly because it was extremely corrupt. And the first attempt to do so is Lord North, and Lord North brings in 1784, 1773. In 1773 brings in the India Bill to regulate the business of the East India Company, to establish a Supreme Court for British India, not leave it... because they had left everything to the company, including justice and so on, and then little by little in Pitt's India Act of 1784, they give more and more power to the state and less to the company. Now in India the situation was quite complex. You had many different kinds of Indian princes who were more or less obliged to pay taxes to the British. Of course, this was a very classic colonial situation. Almost no British company people could speak Indian languages. That's not what they did. They just spoke English, and that was the way. Although for a long time they encouraged Indian schools not to learn English. It's interesting in the first period, and then in the later period they encouraged them to learn English. So this is just a picture to show how complicated it was. The different. This is not one prince each. There's like 200 princes for little regions in the north, and 200 in the east. It's huge. Hundreds of little, relatively little princedoms. Now, the next person will be Warren Hastings, who will work on how to rule India. Now, what's the importance of India for Cook? Well, it's partly the imperial context that this is a huge thing, but also if we think back to the hints made by the Royal Society, and the Royal Society wrote to Cook, and, you know, remember that we're Europeans are not allowed to go around killing local people. I mean, it's like when your parents say, you know, don't go around killing anybody. You say, what were you talking about? I've never killed anybody. And the reason that they gave the hints to Cook is because the Royal Society and many other people, they knew what had happened to Native Americans in North America. They knew what had happened to the Indians, and they knew very well that, you know, the local peoples did not in fact get respect. And so now, I don't think it can be said that the hints of the Royal Society had much effect, but there may well have been this consciousness that there was a need to try to limit the violence, because violence was going to be in there. Worst examples is the Great Bengal Famine of 1770. So this is just after, is while Cook is on the first voyage, and the 10 million people died in the Great Bengal Famine in 1769 to 73, and one of these raw scandalous things is that one of the reasons for it was the destruction of traditional food crops to be replaced by export crops, indigo for dyes, which was very, very important, or opium for poppies. So this was, the British were taking over slowly hundreds of small states in Western India. Small princedoms will be slowly annexed. And John Stuart Mill, whose writings are considered to be great tracts of the Importance of Liberty, was one of the organisers of the MXA. Since this is one of the contradictions of, I was going to say, of the 18th century, but probably of all centuries or most centuries, that, you know, that quite often those putting forward the idea of liberty don't necessarily mean everybody, as we saw when the universal suffrage for many centuries meant just the men, not the women, but they still said universal suffrage. So that was the situation in India. So in this context, the importance of the southern continent, which could be taken possession of, is obvious. The importance is obviously. Similarly, the trade advantage possible in discovering the Northwest Passage would be absolutely phenomenal. We've had a good example this week of how important it can be to have a passage just north of a continent. For example, the Suez Canal. Somebody said to me, imagine you were the captain of the first ship to go through the Suez Canal after they unblocked it this week. And you have the potential to do the funniest thing that anybody had ever done in the history of transport. Well, there you go. That's by the by. So the importance of the Northwest Passage, it would be really big money if you have the Northwest Passage. And also, if they discover the Northwest Passage, they wouldn't necessarily tell all the other countries. Of course, the other countries would eventually discover it. You know, this was about winning. Now, of course, other explorers. So, although the explorers like Cook were obviously very curious and wanted to learn things, the context, it was possible for them to have expeditions because of because they were imperial scouts. And indeed, Cook was not the only. Only 6 years after his death, La Pérouse. How do you spell it? Have I spelled it correctly? Yeah, I'm not sure if it's La Pérouse or La Pérouse, but headed off around the world. You can see he does a huge voyage, and he openly said that his aim was to fill in the blanks which Cook left. It's a bit sad, really, because it's a bit, well, I'm number two. Yeah, I'm number two. Well, there you go. And who is on his ship? Scientists, astronomers, mathematicians, artists to draw the birds and so on, naturalists and so on. Pérouse is a great botanist, and also has a very clear commercial objective. He wants to sell fur. Now, the fur of animals, especially in North America and in Canada, again, this is huge money. Remember that the materials we use today to keep us warm, or the central heating we use today, and this doesn't exist. So animal furs are big money. People will pay a lot for them because, you know, when it's in the winter and you don't have heating in many homes, then you know, that's tremendously important. And La Pérouse sets off with Cook's maps, and also with the maps made by the Spanish. There's this exchange between explorers and indeed Cook. Cook had a lot of writings and maps by other explorers or by other expeditions. He certainly had Wallace's. He had information for Wallace's expedition. Wallace went all the way around the world, but he's best known for being the first European to arrive in Tahiti, and he wrote about it. And so the sailors on Cook's trip said, "Hey, you know, I was reading what Wallace said about Tahiti. The women, oh, you should see." And this was more or less the truth of the situation. So you've got this exchange between sailors, between explorers, but also you've got a context, in which Cook is an imperial scout, and so really, his individual desire to be nice or to be nasty to indigenous people is really not the point. It's an enormous system of which he's a little part. And when he brings home the maps and so on, there's no way that he has any influence at all to stop the colonists massacring the Aboriginals, in particular in Tasmania. They killed almost every last one. In New Zealand, New Zealand's rather special case. There was a lot of massacres, but then there was a treaty. But in any case, you know, there's no way. I mean, Cook had his role, which was an explorer and military officer, to bring back good information for the use of the British Empire. And so much of the debate you see in newspapers today about, you know, was Cook a goodie or a baddie, is just not historical, because that's not a historical question, actually. Was Cook a goodie or a baddie? It's like if you know friends who've been divorced, and you listen to one of them about the story of why there was a divorce, then you listen to the other one. You know, they could be completely different stories about completely different planets. So there you go. That's account as the only teacher who compares Cook to a divorce. And there you go. You do have we do have a moment. I mean, we can finish when I like now, but if you have questions, now is a good time. I just want to check you haven't just spliced in videos of yourself, and you're actually not there. You're just showing a video of yourself. Just filmed yourself. It'd be a good idea when you just film yourself watching one lesson, and then you never have. This is not the best way to pass the aggregation. What can you say? Does anybody have